The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, part one of my conversation with the writer, activist, and regional normal organizer, Chris Goldstein. Christopher, thanks for being on the show today. Now, you and a bunch of normal activists just celebrated Earth Day in New Jersey. And I want to ask you about that, and we'll get to that. But before that, you were down in D.C. for this 420 Week of Unity. And I really want to ask you about that. And we'll get to that, too. But before that, back in March, you had a meeting down in D.C., and which is really what I want to ask you about. And we'll get to that. But first, I think, though, we should lay out the context for that meeting. So let's start, well, it's not so much from the beginning, but more like about, started like 11 or 12 years ago. Tell me about Smokedown Prohibition.
Yeah, Smokedown Prohibition was a civil disobedience protest we decided to undertake. And as an old Quaker, and then I guess I was 10 years younger Quaker, but I have been working and doing peaceful civil disobedience my whole life for different issues. And so I believe in bringing that into cannabis activism, and that's part of the history of our movement, really. This is how we won legalization and how we won attention and awareness for this issue for many years. So I think it's fair game. And about 10 years ago, we decided, hey, we live in Philadelphia. Let's use this historic location to make a point about marijuana prohibition. And in front of Independence Hall, outside on the street, literally on the corner of 5th and Market, urban environment, city of Philadelphia, they have a monument to the First Amendment. And next to this monument, it's a granite block with the First Amendment etched into it. They have a little patio, free speech area. So we decided to come down there once a month at 420 and light some joints and take some pictures and clown around. And we went out there for the first 4 months, and it was great. There were no arrests, no citations. We showed up on April 20th, 2013, and about 1,000 people showed up and joined us. And we smoked joints and clowned around for about a half an hour and left. No arrests, no citations, totally cool. We came back in May, and there were about 50 of us that time. And there were, I'm not kidding around, an army of police for us with the joints. We're talking about 300 or 400 tactically armed law enforcement, Philadelphia Police, National Park Service, Federal Protective Services, and the U.S. attorney, the federal prosecutor, had a tent set up right there to process us. So the question was, do we proceed? So stubborn Quaker activist me, I'm like, sure, let's keep on going. And you know, I have to say, the first time that they came into our crowd, it was quite aggressive, and they really handled a lot of us pretty roughly. And they put a couple of activists in the federal detention center for 5 or 6 days on puffed up charges of, you know, hurting the officers. They were threatened by the joints. So the next decision was, do we go back in June, July, August? Do we keep going? So I went back in June. And I hadn't gotten cited in May, so I went back in June, and I led the protest, and I got cited for the first time. Same setup. Hundreds of police, federal prosecutor out there. We light joints, and they wrote us tickets. So I paid my first ticket. It's $175. Now, I went back, and in August, I got my second ticket. And when they brought me to the tent, the federal prosecutor instructed the officer to remand me to court for a trial. So now they have arrested me for half a gram of cannabis, Doug, and they put me on trial, which lasted almost 6 months. The Rangers came and testified. They were worried about their safety with us. You know, National Park Rangers have riot gear. I didn't know that, but they do. And it's green, and they brought it out for us. So it was a very interesting scenario. Anyway, in March of 2014, I stood before a federal magistrate judge in Philadelphia for what turned out to be one of the scarier moments of my life, which was the judge telling me, you know, Mr. Goldstein, I really thought about putting you in prison for 30 days. And let me tell you, if you violate the probation that I'm about to assign, I will put you in prison for 30 days for every violation of it. They assigned me 24 months of supervised probation, a $3,000 cash fine, and a permanent federal criminal record for half a gram of marijuana. And I got 40 drug tests, and I managed to get through probation. My attorney, who was a really great man and helped me through my case, unfortunately passed away halfway through my probation. We were going to continue with appeals and things like that, but I couldn't do it without a pro bono attorney at the federal level. So there it was. Anyway, I served out my time, and but I still have a federal record, and it does make some things weird. As somebody who is an adjunct instructor at Temple University and looks for adjunct jobs, and I'm a guest lecturer even today at Stockton and some other places, any interaction with students on any level, you have to get a criminal background check. And all it comes up as, it doesn't say half a gram of marijuana. It just says that I have a federal marijuana record, which, of course, to anybody reading it on the surface, sounds like I imported tons of weed or something. So that's why the pardons were kind of really important. So in October of 2022, President Biden issued a mass pardon for federal marijuana possession. And it took him about 6 months to put an interface online to apply. So in March of 2023, I applied for the pardon and I didn't hear anything back right away. Now, it got to be December and the president issued another proclamation, an expanded pardon. And this included all these specific codes, like the National Park Service code. And all of a sudden, in January, just weeks after that December pardon, I got an email from the Department of Justice, which kind of makes you sweat a little bit. And you wonder if you're getting in trouble again or something. But the email came from the Department of Justice. And in it, this is how they do it now. You are told that you have been pardoned. You get an instruction on what that means, that your record remains, but you have been forgiven by the president. And then instead of sending your pardon in the mail, they send you a PDF with a picture of the pardon that is on file at the Department of Justice. So it's very modern. And so I printed mine out and I'm going to get it in different sizes, like business card size, T-shirt, maybe, So the pardon is good because my record does remain. So if anybody searches my record, whether that be at the border of a country or in the case of employment, I can give them a copy of my pardon in advance and say, you're going to see this on my record. And this is the president has pardoned me for this offense. So it means something. So although I know it's like the lowest level of pardon and it is the sort of first step that any president could do, we've asked every president to do this since Nixon. And this is the first president that has done any of this stuff. The pardons, the scheduling review, talking about marijuana reform. I mean, we all wanted President Obama to do this, all of this. And it feels like President Biden and Vice President Harris have dusted off a plan that was left over from the Obama administration a little bit. But I must say, we were sort of chatting off air before this about, the intensity of the election and the politics around drug policy right now. But the politics around marijuana is very interesting. We are a voting bloc in this country. We have showed up in election after election. We are not a partisan voting bloc. We include people for Democrats and Republicans vote for legalization. And we've gone state to state now. In New Jersey, 4 years ago, 3 million people showed up to legalize cannabis. That is more votes than any single candidate has ever received in this state. And you can only get that with bipartisan support. So even though we've legalized marijuana and it can't be on the ballot again this year, the voters who voted for it are still out here. So you can talk to us. We could show up for you. And that means something real big because, again, cannabis voters are committed. We're dedicated. We do show up. We do vote. And on ballot initiatives, you have to really try. You have to find it on the ballot. You have to make sure that you select the right thing. So the 3 million people who show up to legalize marijuana in New Jersey, the millions who do it in election after election nationwide, this is perhaps one of the most, to me, one of the most interesting and active voting blocks in the country. And sort of an open block. We back candidates all the time. And I explain this to people now in this Dune sense, since Dune is a very popular movie. I loved all the books. But cannabis voters are like the Fremen. You cannot count us. You know, we're out there. We're like mixed in with everybody else. But on election day, you feel our power. We are the election power on election day. So we really show up.
This is my conversation with the writer, activist, and regional normal organizer, Chris Goldstein. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Well, first, congratulations on the pardon. And that brings us up to one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which was this meeting you had back in March down here in D.C. Part of it was behind closed doors, and I realize you can't really talk about that part. But part of it was out front Okay, well, tell me about this meeting you had down in D.C.
Yeah, we can talk behind closed doors. Okay. It's not that it was cut off from us discussing what happened in the meeting. It's that the press wasn't allowed. There was a portion at the very beginning that everybody got to see on the live stream, which was the press portion. And then they closed the door to the press, and they had a meeting with all of us at the table. So generally, first of all, it was a really incredible experience. The vice president's staff and everybody who works at the White House are working at the top level. They all work really, really hard to keep everything running over there. And I've been around Washington politics for a long time. And between COVID and breaking my leg a couple of years ago, it's been a while since I've been in D.C. I certainly haven't seen it. I wasn't there for the entire previous administration, that's for sure. I don't think I've been back since President Obama was there. So I found it to be really energizing to be around the White House right now. Vice President Harris and President Biden have a really young, astute team around them, and they've elevated so many women to positions of power within the institution. The Department of Justice, the pardon attorney, her name is Liz Oyer, and she's the first defense attorney to be the pardon attorney at the DOJ. Used to be prosecutors in that job, Doug, seriously. So she's really changed the tone of the office, and she's brought in a lot of other women who worked as defense attorneys around the country. Again, if you ever wanted to see a change, a generational change in elevating women into all the positions of power around things like the Department of Justice and the White House, the Biden administration and Vice President Harris have done that. Other than the President of the United States, if you wanted to see the White House run by women, that's what's happening right now. And it is a really cool thing to see. I think that is one of the best generational changes we've made in D.C. thus far. So that was cool. Getting invited to the White House is, you know, I did a meeting with the vice president's staff, and I thought it was just a meeting to talk about the pardons. And at the very end of the meeting, they're like, oh, we'd like to do an event about these in D.C. And, you know, I was like, oh, that's great. I'd love to help. I'm like, where would that be? And they're like, oh, here at the White House. I'm like, oh, wow, this is how you get invited to the White House. So there's a lot of, you know, setup and formalities and things that go into it, but it wasn't just me. There were two other people who received clemency. And so I received, my pardon was for this half a gram of possession 10 years ago. And the Department of Justice created a really cool interface website so that people could apply for these mass pardons to see if they're eligible. So I used the website. I put all my information in there, my docket, when I got the ticket, and I got an email back with my pardon. Very cool. Now, before the president's mass pardon, people could apply for individual clemency, but that was a much more drawn out process. Like literally, if I wanted clemency for my half a gram, two FBI agents would have had to come to my house and talk to me. Really? So what I found interesting, what was interesting about, and I'll get to the White House visit a little bit, but before I went to the White House, I got to go visit the pardon attorney's office at the Department of Justice. And so I got to go there and meet the pardon attorney and her staff, and they're all really dedicated people. And they're processing clemency every day. I mean, we talk about clemency. They're the ones who are actually trying to get it done. And I gained a deep respect for everybody there. So they innovated with the president's pardon. They took some people who had individually applied, and they have a backlog of these, and advanced some. So they said, hey, look, we don't have to send the FBI agents out for these, this, and this. So the woman who was there with me at the White House, her name is Michelle. She had applied for an individual clemency request years ago. And so after the December proclamation, they just sent her pardon in the email. The gentleman who was there with us, his name is Dexter. He had a more serious case. And he went to prison for 4 months, federal prison for 4 months, because he texted a friend of his who was under federal investigation about buying a small amount of marijuana. And so he served 4 months in prison. This was, again, you know, a little over about a decade ago. But he received, he put in an individual clemency request, and he received individual clemency from President Biden in 2022. So it was Dexter, Michelle, and me. We were the pardon recipients. We were invited in. And then it was the rapper named Fat Joe. And part of my job was to make Fat Joe look skinny, because I need to get on his diet plan, because I definitely have a few pounds on Fat Joe. Some of the other people there were Governor Andy Beshear, governor of Kentucky, who's done a lot of work in his state on clemency and medical marijuana. Also at the table were two advisors to President Biden and the Democratic Policy Commission. So there we were at the table in the Roosevelt Room, Doug, which was kind of awesome, because you know who designed and built the Roosevelt Room was Richard Nixon. So here we are in the room that Nixon built, talking about ending marijuana prohibition. And I think the surprising thing for me was when the doors closed, was that Vice President Harris talked a lot more than marijuana, that the discussion was about the differences in sentencing between crack and powder cocaine, that there were bigger issues with justice in the bigger, wider drug war. She also took on her own record as a prosecutor, which is something that we as a community often remind her of. Pretty much at any instance that Vice President Harris talks about marijuana reform, people bring up the fact that she indeed prosecuted thousands of cases. But as a Quaker, I have to say, this is one of the things that is important about President Biden and Vice President Harris and their shift on marijuana. They are drug warriors, and they are not afraid of that record. They're not ashamed of their record as drug warriors either, and you're never going to hear them express that. However, they both do want to go in a different direction. And to me, as a Quaker, we talk about declaring peace instead of declaring war, and that when the warriors are the ones who are declaring peace, that it maybe sticks a little bit more when you get the soldiers to lay down their swords. So I think that, I mean, President Obama was amazing. I'm still a super fan of the guy, but he was not a drug warrior, and he did not take on marijuana prohibition like this administration is. This is the first presidential administration to take this issue on head on since Nixon, and they are turning it. They've turned the message 180. They're talking about reform. They're talking about clemency. Every administration before was either arm's length or President Nixon's attitude, pretty much. So I do have to give this administration credit where it's due. I hate to say it. I mean, even with the passage of the MORE Act a few years ago in the House, right now, President Biden, Vice President Harris have probably done more to advance federal reform in the last couple of years than Congress has in the last 50. So it really is a tough position to be in. So anyway, I think what happened in the room in the closed door session was surprising to me. It was kind of like everything. I wish everything that Vice President Harris said in the closed door session was what the public got to hear. Because too often, I think on this issue, their message is a little bit off. There's no other way to say it. President Biden had a chance during the State of the Union to say pardons, and he said expungements. I still have a record, unfortunately. Even with the pardon, I still need my record expunged. Anybody who gets a pardon right now still needs Congress to act to get actually clear our records. So when given the opportunity to connect here, I think that there were some missed opportunities for sure. But 420, just this weekend, President Biden, Vice President Harris tweeted at 420 on 420. And that's really the first time the White House sort of connected with millions of people at that moment. So I think it's the first time we could say that the White House celebrated 420 with us. And I do think that that is an interesting place to have any White House be. I wish it had been the Obama White House. But I do believe that Vice President Harris and what I saw in that meeting personally gave me a lot more confidence in where the direction that they're taking this, because I heard a lot of let's deal with marijuana in the short term and let's get to those bigger issues with the drug war in the long term, because these are the different directions that the country wants to take. I was super impressed with all that, quite honestly. I expected it to be all about marijuana clemency. And I think that the bigger issues that you and I have talked about for decades, Doug, these are the root core issues that are not being missed by some of the smartest people at the top. They're having a hard time communicating that with the public at times, but it really felt good that most of the people in that room were so well-schooled on all this, as well-schooled as you and I.
That's, yeah, took Nixon to open up relations with China. Nixon, the arch anti-communist. It couldn't have been one of the Democrats.
Yeah. So, I mean, and there was a moment, I've been saying this around. I mean, she did stop the room for a moment, and this is not a new position for the vice president, might I add. This was her position before she joined the ticket. But she said, I just need to say it. We need to legalize marijuana. And if she could be allowed to say that in a much more public and consistent forum, it would really seal the deal on so much right now. But again, she is the vice president. And right now, President Biden's official position is decriminalization, not full legalization. So that's the funny, weird semantics that we're in.
Now, you mentioned 420. You participated in the 420 Week of Unity. I saw the news conference you had with SSDP. You're talking about the pardons, you and Valerie DeRochelles. And but that 420 Week of Unity, what was that? What was all that about? You went to the White House, smoked a joint in front again. What did you do? You bad boy.
Well, you know, the Unity Week was really interesting. So the thing I did with Kat was actually that was a presentation. That was our fireside chat for SSDP, actually. The Last Prisoner Project and SSDP did do a press conference. I wasn't there for that, though, but I have to say they did a great job with that. The number of legislators and a number of celebrities really participated in the Unity Day on 4/18. So what we saw was sort of a classic citizen lobbying day. And it was a lot of folks who flew into D.C. from around the country to make sure that they met with their members of Congress. Now, good thing was, is that on 4/18, the Senate and House were in session. The members of Congress were there. And Chuck Schumer introduced the Senator Schumer. He's from New York. He introduced the CAOA, which is the new federal reform vehicle. I guess the most diplomatic way to put it is that's the placeholder bill for federal cannabis reform, only because people don't expect it to pass this year like anything else. There were only a little over 25 bills passed in Congress last year for anything. So the idea that's why all the other bills sort of come up. So back to our Unity Day. I got to hang out with some SSDP college students from here in New Jersey. It's their first trip to Washington, D.C. Got to take them on those lobbying meetings for the first time. They got the gallery pass to go into the house gallery and visit there. And it's an awesome feeling to go to D.C. and do this kind of work, even as a volunteer for a day. I recommend anybody who has the opportunity to do it. Your members of Congress always treat you better than your state legislators. Okay. So like if you do any state level politics, it's always like a breath of fresh air. Everybody's so nice. And they're like nice to you and they listen. They look like they're listening. They take notes. State level, you can't even like get the door to open or anybody answer the phone, like email for 3 weeks to get like a text message back with like four letters in it. So DC is a good experience for most citizen lobbyists. And our cannabis message was really popular. I mean, 420 week is not lost on the people in Congress. It is something that there is a high awareness for. National Normal, we put out one of our action alerts, and it turned out to be one of our most successful of the year, with more than 12,000 responses in less than a week. So we went into Congress, and they had all gotten our emails, believe me. I mean, when you get the volume of over 10,000, you know that every office got some, and you know that some offices got thousands of them in some cases. So that was a good turnout. The press and media, Jason Ortiz at the Last Prisoner Project absolutely crushed the organization side of Unity Day. It wasn't easy. It was a super ambitious schedule. It included numerous members of Congress, lots of organizations, but I have to say he pulled it off. And he gave credit to Justin Streckel and some of the people who came along and built the groundwork for it. But I think Jason and Last Prisoner Project, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and the National Cannabis Festival found their groove this year. So I saw them sort of get their align this year. There's always things that you can do better. I am a little worried that in some ways what I saw was a lot more gatekeeping than I've seen in the past. Grassroots activism, you want to be able to make grassroots activism accessible to the actual grassroots volunteers. When they come to DC, they should be able to meet with legislators and participate as much as your high-level people and as much as your celebrity people. And in the past, that ebbs and flows, and it's hard to get everybody's attention in time. But in order to make sure that a grassroots movement is strong and growing, when people come to DC, you can't gatekeep too much. So I'm feeling a lot of gatekeeping around DC, and that's tough to see. But I also see a lot of drug policy organizations with a shrunken staff and things like that, too. So there's less people professionally working on the issue than there used to be in the past. People have asked me why that is. And unfortunately, a lot of the best people in the politics side have gone on to work on the industry side. So we used to be much better. Like SSDP and Normal used to be a booster for politics. Our volunteers used to become congressional staffers and then members of Congress or a state legislator. Now it seems like most of our volunteer base is interested in becoming an entrepreneur, which, again, that's America. But that also leaves us without the institutional knowledge that you really need for sustained decades of representation from a grassroots community. So, again, that's why I keep doing this. That's why I think it's important. As a Quaker, I learned all this activism and organizing stuff and the generational side of it from a different perspective. So that's why I'm in my late 40s now, trying to feed in that generational perspective back into cannabis activism too, and show people that you have to train up the next generation if you expect them to be there representing you when you're old.
That was the first half of my conversation with writer, activist, and Regional Normal organizer Chris Goldstein. Tune in next week for part two. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now,
for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.